And before I turn the floor over to Professor David McDonald, Chair of History, who will introduce our speaker for today, I just want to call your attention to next week's end of the semester event, which will feature Professor Bob Kaiser, who is Chair of the Department of Geography, and who's going to lecture on Estonia's Bronze Knight, reassembling the event. And following Professor Kaiser's lecture next week, we'll have our now traditional holiday Krika celebration, which will have a reception with goodies and refreshments. So I encourage everybody to attend next week to hear Professor Kaiser and to celebrate another semester coming to a close. Without further ado, I believe most of you know Professor David McDonald, Chair of the History Department.
Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know, my name is David McDonald. I'm a Chair of the Department of History. I'm also a specialist in the history of the Russian Empire, and I'm relieved because if there's this many people in the room, you're not here to hear me. You're here to hear my friend and colleague, Anna Krylova, the Hunt Assistant Professor of Modern Russian History at Duke University. Those of you who study Russian history might remember Krylova for an absolutely blockbuster article she published in the first issue of what is probably now the hot journal in Russian history, Kritsika, a historiographical survey of the state of a highly contested field at the time, in which she drew connections among historians who would probably not speak to one another at the same conference, except in the most measured and polite terms, to show how they were all connected, but they knew it, by a similarly unexamined assumption about the stable nature of sort of post-Kantian or liberal subjectivity. And she suggested that this was probably the last place one should start in order to understand what made people experience and mediate and react to what was taking place in their lives during the period, the Soviet period of Russian history. Since then, she has really proceeded from that rather narrow analytic base in pursuit of a project which began as a dissertation looking at the generation of people who would become really the first generation of truly Soviet, at least by the lights of the time, Soviet citizens, people born just before the Great War, who came of age entirely pretty much under the new state, political order, and social order that the Bolsheviks were so busy and energetically constructing to more or less effect in the 1920s and 1930s. And looking at the challenges that this generation faced among itself, the challenges that were thrust upon it, but also the ambiguities and ambivalence they faced in constructing their own identities, as well as on the part of older generations of the people who had actually made the revolution or lost in the revolution. This dissertation, in turn, has morphed into a much broader book that is coming out with Cambridge Press this spring, entitled Soviet Women in Combat, A History of Violence on the Eastern Front, which now takes the members of this generation and looks at them. I won't steal her talk, but looks at the way the Soviet experience combined to bring together gender, new ways of talking and thinking about and performing gender, the new conditions of a changing or self-consciously transformative society, and, as we know, a war that we think of having begun in June of 1941, at least on the Soviet side, but which in actual fact had a long backward shadow that really forms the heart of, the basis for the narrative she pursues. She'll be speaking about that today. I was just informed, Anna just told me that this is the first time that she will be speaking about the book and asked me, and I suppose through me, all of you, to bear with her. Those of you who've heard her speak before know that that isn't going to be a problem. She absolutely bursts with ideas and insights, suggestions, and provocations to further thought. So instead of monopolizing her time or encroaching on it, I'll simply cede the floor and ask you with me to welcome Anna Krylova.
I guess so.
Thank you very much for this introduction. And it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for coming on this, I mean, probably very typical snowing and day for Wisconsin, completely shock for me. Though I have come to Wisconsin through via Canada, so it was this kind of short preparation for the talk here. So I actually, this is the first time I'm presenting on book where my book, when I have more than 20 minutes. And it's a very challenging topic where you have 20 minutes, you know that you don't have any high expectations to basically talk about the book as a whole. When you get to 40, 45 minutes, you actually become very ambitious and you want to talk about the whole thing. And that is impossible, basically. So I have designed a certain strategy of how to enter into the subject and then to take you through certain parts of it, but a larger, so some parts will be missing. So what I will do, I will actually start in the 1960s, in 1970s, and I will introduce the figure of the female veteran and male veteran in 1960s. And also, I will introduce, before I talk about a portrait of a Soviet woman as a citizen, as the citizen soldier, I want to talk about about the Soviet woman as a World War II memoirist. And having posed kind of a female and a male of the World War II memoirs as a certain problematic, I will try to go into the 1930s, and I will try to figure out what was the cultural capital that enabled that type of memoir writing in 1960s. And then at the end, I will end with some theoretical and interpretive, I will basically articulate some interpretive and theoretical challenges that I faced while I worked on this project, and also how I tried to solve them. So there will be a little bit of repetition at the end, I believe, if I hope I'll have time. So I want to take you into the middle of the 1960s, more specifically even to 1967, in May, on May 9th, Victory Day, which marked the defeat of Nazi Germany in the Soviet-German War of 1941 and 45, was a very young holiday. Actually, formally, it was only 2 years old. But informally, the early days of May, already basically, the early day of May would always unmistakably actually betray that there had been a long tradition among Soviet generals or Soviet veterans to celebrate the day, May 9th, as the Victory Day. And actually, not just the May 9th, but the whole week before May 9th would be a week where veterans would be gathering together in squares. They would be traveling sometimes very far distances to places where they fought. Not everyone could afford it, but in general, in the early days of May, the Soviet society would undergo a major transformation. A significant amount of Soviet people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and World War II in Russia was a people's war, so all generations were involved. They would go through the major kind of transformation. They will change their civil dresses. They will put on their festive dresses, festive suits, festive outfits, and they would usually also put their medals on. And in a sense, they will kind of try to kind of mark whatever they're wearing with a military signifier or something. So in this way, they would come outside. They would go on the streets. And in my understanding of that moment, it was kind of a symbolic gesture where, for several days, the Soviet society will be divided into two major camps: those who had fought and those who had not fought. And so the veteran is turning himself or herself, and then again, in a self-advertising war veteran, kind of in a public, making himself or herself into a public site. And I have already betrayed it, but since the talk is about women in combat, the Soviet divide between those who fought and who hadn't fought would not be a gender divide. You would always see young women in the crowd. And you would immediately guess that these young women will be the youngest generation among the combatants. They will be in their 40s, while the majority of men will be in their 50s, 60s, and some of them actually will be in their 70s. So you can see that this is a very young generation, which also developed for itself a particular outfit. An attempt of that outfit was to make sure that the veteran community is not uniformly male. So what these women would do, they would dress in, this is a very dramatic military outfit, but where a female will wear her military outfit with all medals, but she would always have flowers to just signify her kind of clearly that womanhood. And also she would have longer hair, and some of them would wear makeup, some of them would be extremely extravagantly dressed, but they will have their medals. So this would be an inclusive outfit for female veteran. And for generations that grew up in the Soviet Union after World War II, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and up to the present day, the image of a female veteran is very typical, and it's not a surprising or shocking veteran. We just basically, everyone who goes to Moscow or any other major city in May Days, like Russian veterans are a mixed group, and actually the longer it gets, the more women remain and the more male. Actually, not only because that men live not as long, especially in contemporary Russia, but also because women were the youngest generation that participated in the war, and they are very, so the last surviving Soviet veteran of World War II is very likely to be a female. This woman is, just like took this picture in 1997 in front of the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow, where she is celebrating with her male friends. She basically she's meeting her comrades in arms, and they usually will be singing. So this kind of formerly very useful, very familiar image actually was not that transparent in terms of what it meant, what exactly this female veteran actually meant. What the male veteran meant, one can kind of might make it just what he was probably a soldier, though the majority of modern soldiers actually do not fight, like actually a very small percentage of modern military actually fights. Majority of them work in support and reserve troops. But usually we will not ask questions about what exactly men did while being veterans, but we will ask what did exactly women do at the front. So in a sense, my question would be, what were they trying to communicate to the Soviet society? What identities they were trying to construct and preserve by this type of movement, kind of self-representation, and merging themselves with the veteran community, basically fixing it as a male-female group. So what I want to say is that, kind of this is a personal note, that the question of what exactly did they do at the front would never come up for me. Like, and for generation that, like I'm not a generation of the 60s, but a generation of the 80s, but for a lot of generations from 60s, 70s, the question what women did at the front would not come up because the answer would seem to be so obvious what they had done that people would not ask. And the answer would be, of course, they were medics, they were telephone operators, they were telegraph operators, they were doctors, they were nurses, they were clerks. I mean, they basically were anything except they were combatants. And this kind of, the effect of post-war Soviet society, post-war popular culture, to kind of create this image of a female veteran as a totalizing non-combatant, basically, so is an incredible achievement. So if we ever doubt that Soviet system had some successes in its ideological production, that is one of the successes. Like, I never asked the question who these women were until I came to the United States, because I accidentally looked at the Pravda and I saw a lot of females with guns in the 1940s. Why would my generation perceive this female veterans as non-combatants? It will be thanks to extremely popular Soviet literature, an avalanche of Soviet films, and it actually didn't matter who the author was in terms of whether the author was opposed to the Soviet system or he was critical of the Soviet World War II effort, or he was actually pro-Soviet and was trying to celebrate. In all this enormous multiplication of kind of war-inspired literature, and even if the author like Vasily Grossman would be banned, they all actually still operate with this idea that there is this one kind of idea of the little doctor, woman doctor, or a little woman telegraph operator, and it will be always little, something very small, something really not foreign, who would be the main character, like a main secondary character in Soviet novels and Soviet films. And what is even more important is that this particular, in Soviet novels and Soviet films, these female characters would not even be allowed to think of the possibility of them being combatants. So they would be presented as never, that the thought of being a combatant had never occurred to them. Like they just somehow happened to be thrown into this horrible World War II scene and they survived, but they were not capable of thinking of themselves as combatants. And so there was this interesting major kind of interpretive accomplishment on the part of the post-war popular culture in the Soviet Union where, in a sense, the Soviet writers, popular writers, allowed women to be in the trenches, to be in combat, and the trenches become actually already a shared space, but the art of combat remains to be still a male duty and a male prerogative. So, so at the same time, in the Soviet Yeah. So at the same time, like this kind of popular culture themes and thematizing of female veterans as non-combatants and trying to preserve combat for male and non and kind of it was a very paradoxical, right? Like combat is male, but women are all around combat. So there was another stream of literature that was extremely prolific and starting from 1960s, going 1980s, and also going into basically still happening. It would be veteran literature that would not be as popular. I mean, it would not be would be very popular within the veteran community, but would never reach out to the mass reader or mass viewer or television viewer of the 1960s and 80s. And kind of the only place where that literature would be circulating will be circulating in gatherings of veterans, or it will be just lying in bookstores and no one would ever think of reading those books because they were under the kind of, they were in special section of bookstores, political education. And I, like most people, would not consider books under the umbrella political ideological education as exciting or interesting books. So they would, so it was, but it was not the only reason. So one, so the books that would be gathering, that would be kind of gathered in there would be actually kind of an endless effort of Soviet veterans to write their own accounts of what happened. And a lot of accounts would be actually offered by men and by female and male veterans who would be trying to talk about, like, we will be actually offering a very different gender landscape for the front and a very different gendered, kind of different gendered identities, what kind of woman and meaningful manhood and womanhood and soldierhood. And just kind of one of the examples of what those type of publications looked like, they were actually usually published by state publishing houses, since there was no other publishing houses. But this is a book that, and women would kind of choose their illustrators. They would be able to choose sketches for themselves when they didn't have pictures of themselves from the war. So this is a book written by Valentina Chudakova, who was a female. He was first a machine gunner, then she became a male commander, or she became a commander of a male machine gun platoon and then machine gun company. And just on the level of a company, she was in charge, what it meant that she was in charge of four male machine gun crews with different, like, so about 25 men were under her command. And then she, so that's the kind of illustration she chose for her book, where we actually already kind of, like this, in terms of imagery, like we're confronted with a very unexpected representation. First of all, there is factual and also interpretive kind of shock, I mean, surprising narrative about the war, where a woman clearly, by, if we look at her shoulders, we can see that she is an officer, we can see that there is a machine gun up there, she is ordering men around, and they are standing in a very obedient manner. This is how Chudakova remembered World War II. And women would actually use a lot of that type of, kind of, they would use sketches and also their languages. So what I, when I would be reading, when I, if I would read, I didn't read the 1960s because I was completely ignorant of that literature, but had I been reading that literature in the 1960s, but I wasn't even born yet, so like in the 70s or 80s, so I would be very surprised. I would be like, a woman machine gunner, like writing on behalf of her male combatants, because Chudakova was writing, of course, on behalf of all male and female combatants. He specifically, well, she was, specifically was not interested in writing about women. She was specifically interested in writing about men and women and in combat and kind of modern mechanized warfare. So I would be very, I would be just basically shocked. And what I want to suggest is that for me, so this memoirs by both men and women represent not just a factual correction that we actually just need to add another fact to the World War II history on the Eastern Front, it also represents an interpretive historical challenge. Because if we look at the way the narratives actually develop in those memoirs, and also I trace them in the book from diaries in the 1930s through letters in the 1940s, and also like all the publications of women kind of authored in the 1940s while they were at the front, if we actually read those narratives, we come up with a kind of, one can construct a very complex picture of World War II where a different kind of language, a very different language from what the popular culture offered actually would be used regularly and consistently. So what Chudakova and also would do, Chudakova basically will talk about her volunteering in 1941 in June, this is when the attack on Germans took place, and she would usually say, her narrative is representative. That's why I'm retracing it, and I'm also using this by retracing so that I can tell you kind of what the book is covering in a very quick manner. So she volunteered in 1941 before she knew that there was any emergency at the front. The officers who took her, like the conscription officers who enlisted her first as a medic and then promoted her into medic into machine gun unit, also didn't know that there was actually an emergency. So the idea that it was a pragmatic decision on the part of the Soviet state doesn't work until August of 1941, and the majority of women, thousands of women, who volunteered in June of 22nd, and then for the first 2 weeks, they basically were going into war because they wanted a chance. They didn't want to save the country. They didn't think that the country was yet in danger. So by later, these women would already, of course, be informed that there was some problem if the German troops are not far from Moscow. And they would be using that as another kind of not, kind of as an appropriate excuse to get in. But again, kind of their original motivation of going into war because they thought that that was a logical place for them to be, and not seeing this opposition between themselves and combat, and not seeing the opposition between them and men in relation to combat, would be the way they will be narrating their volunteering story. Their volunteering story will be, when I heard the news of the war, I knew what to do. I went to the conscription site. So this omission of reflection, which kind of enacting of already deeply thought through script, to me was representative that we have a different logic that these women obviously following. And it doesn't mean that they don't know about more conventional or more traditional ways of imagining the front, that the front is a male space. For them, it was not relevant. Like that not everyone was supposed to volunteer, but their generation was supposed to volunteer. So, and they were specifically, in their memoirs, they were specifically used the Russian words as woman soldier, женщина солдат, боец, женщина солдат. And then we'll also use notions of woman machine gunner, женщина пулеметчица, or woman pilot, woman sniper. And the bringing together of these two identities into a new social identity, which will be presented as not having an inherent opposition or contradiction, would be extremely, like, that would be kind of the leitmotif of the whole narrative, that they would be trying to work for me and for their audience, I'm supposed to read, this idea that a soldier and a woman, I mean, actually, when I first was presenting, kind of just presenting my work, I was, people were saying, like, no, wait, combat is male. And I would be like, yes, in general, but, you know, for, like, you have this extremely well-developed, like, very extremely well-developed cultural code, very well-developed cultural codes, which young women actually used, and then also they used in their memoirs to actually reinterpret how exactly the home front and the front should relate to each other, and they present it as kind of two things. First of all, the front is a shared territory between men and women, and the identity of the soldier is no longer basically as a uniform position. It's a split position, a legitimately split between men and women. So so I want to pose Chudakova. Actually, I was supposed to pose a completely different figure, but since I forgot. So, yes. Okay, so I want to pose this Chudakova, who wrote her memoirs in the 1960s, as a cultural, historical enigmatic figure. Because if we will read her memoirs in relation to the cultural product, kind of popular culture of 1960s in the Soviet Union, it's not very clear what cultural paradigms and cultural tools she's using, what she's drawing on, how exactly was she constituted as a subject. Because there is absolutely nothing immediately in the Soviet culture of the 60s that can actually help her to write her own memoirs. And in fact, she appears to be a revisionist. She appears to be a very consistent revisionist of the master narrative that is being produced in post-World War II Soviet Union. And also, I would like to mention that a lot of these women who would be, like, their novels and their memoirs and their recollections will circulate among the units that they fought with, which they were, which they had fought together, and usually these women will present themselves as writing on behalf of their male comrades, and male comrades would usually accept that. And in this, in like to kind of to write a memoir-length text by a trench-level machine gunner or trench-level machine gun commander or a sniper or like pilot, but not trench level, of course, but there's combat pilot, would be very extraordinary thing, because usually like ordinary soldiers don't write master narratives about how the war happened from 41 to 44. Usually, like, for example, comrades in arms of Chudakova would mostly write, and also other women would write short sketches about like kind of scenes, moments, recollections, sometimes including women, sometimes excluding women, but never like an attempt to write the whole history of World War I. So the the memoirs that Chudakova wrote actually will cover 1941 to 1943. And she also planned to write, she wrote two memoirs. But her narrative will begin in 1941 when she, as I already said, when she volunteered because she had the sense that she had impulse and she knew what was the correct organization of gender divisions. And then she would, the whole, like the volunteering narrative will be a narrative where she would account different male authorities, and there will be absolutely no prediction how they will react to her. There will be male officers who would think she was completely crazy. And there will be male officers who would not agree right away, but then they will reflect and they will think, actually, why not? Why not? Why shouldn't women fight? And there will be also male authorities who would be quite cooperative in helping women to get into combat when there will be some resistance from, for example, from men who are volunteering with the woman. So there will be these multiple situations in which I'll just go through my interpretation. I interpret as what is happening in the Soviet Union in 1941, in June, July, and August, and for the rest of the war, is that the idea of the soldier is being discussed, debated, and questioned. So the society is actually, I don't want to perceive it as resistance or by men and women who are trying to get into the front. I want to perceive that the possibility itself of having a conversation where a woman belongs, and whether she belongs to the front, and whether a machine gunner can be a woman. The fact that this discussion is taking place actually indicates a major radical kind of shift in societal perceptions of gender. And we actually need to go and figure out what exactly gender meant in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, because it's already there in 1941. How many notions and discourses of gender were there in operation? Because if we clearly see traditional, like where there is the resistance, but we also need to understand how was it possible for Chudakova and for other women, and we're talking about 500,000 women who were just in the regular army and 300,000 women who were in anti-aircraft brigades, and a majority of them actually wanted to be in combat but didn't know that the army doesn't consist of combat, but there are all other divisions there. So how is it possible for them and for other to think about a woman soldier or a woman soldier as not inherently contradictory category? And how is it possible for men to basically start making a correction? They cannot say soldier anymore without identifying the gender of soldier. They have to say man soldier. And this is also мужчина боец. So like the fact that the society has to make this explication in 1940s is an incredibly, extremely extremely significant of larger cultural changes. And of course, it cannot possibly happen in just 1 month in 1942 and 41. So for that, I want to retrace our steps and to go into 1930s and to see what kind of notions of gender were in operation in Stalinist society in the 30s, and also how they were used and how they were institutionalized. So in my book, I actually, of course, first of all, one goes to the secondary school. You go to the Soviet schools and you look at how this generation was educated. But I visit many institutional sites in the 1930s. And actually, speaking of my dissertation became chapter one. Yeah, and the rest, I think it's like six chapters. It was done rethinking things, thinking things through. So the dissertation kind of we can show if we want. So, and so the sites are basically are proposed in terms of method, like methodology, of the sites where one should go in order to find out what was happening are very self-evident from women's memoirs, from women's diaries, and women's letters. I go into schools, I kind of look at how school education and school reforms were kind of carried out in the 1930s. And then I also go, since the 1930s, it's the 1930s is a pre-war decade, and I already mentioned it during the workshop, that the whole Soviet society knew in 1931 that they were already entering into pre-war decade. So these young people are living in the pre-war decade, preparing for war. And the Soviet leadership, of course, is creating all this paramilitary sites where they can prepare for war, because if actually the war is coming, the young generation that is chosen as the generation to fight the war, not yet their grandfathers and grandfathers are not included in the 30s into this kind of World War II effort. So of course it's actually, this is a rational choice theory, maybe once that works, where you prepare, you actually want to learn how to shoot the rifle, you want to learn how to shoot the machine gun, and if it doesn't work out and you're not good at it, you'll be upset. And I have all this lot of recollections by women who in their diaries where they describe how they went to learn how to shoot the machine gun, and of course it didn't go well first time, and they come back and they say, my fascist still remains not dead, or like my fascist remains alive, and that is really disheartening. So the kind of the side of paramilitary education, also the side where the paramilitary education of highly technical skills were necessary, like flying clubs, and also even some spaces where women were learning and men were learning tanks or something that looked like a tank. Then I'll show you something that looks like a tank. And then, of course, popular culture. I'm of course interested in Soviet press, literature, especially film, and kind of from there on I go into the war period, but I will probably not go into war period today. How this kind of so that right now I will be able to only take you to the Soviet school in 1930s. And to see how, and also kind of to see what different notions of gender actually were integrated and used in institutionalization of Soviet education in 1930s. And I think probably I would like to preempt it by saying that all the sites that I am kind of visiting in the book, if they have anything in common, they have in common like this constant discussion and disagreement about how gender differences actually should play out in the next war. So it is present in the school, but to a lesser degree too. And outside of the school, there is a discussion of what gender relations mean and what exactly they entail for this generation that is supposed to fight. And I also want to, kind of very briefly, but this is an important part of my research, is that in order to understand the gender discourses of Stalinist period in 1930s, and also just we need to realize that all the basic notions that we believe we have a sense of grasping the meaning, such as gender, women's equality, bourgeois gender prejudices, they actually all were subjects that were discussed throughout the decade. And for that, we really need to figure out actually what exactly gender meant and in the Soviet context. And in gender in the Soviet context actually had the Soviet society and had like that spoke the ones that I'm exploring basically speaks Russian language, they're using a Russian word for gender that is very actively used in the 20s and 30s, which is pol. And as I already mentioned in the workshop, I'm going, in Russia, a Russian word for gender, pol, could never be used and still cannot be used as one word. It's always used as a relational category. It's usually gender relations. Or it's gender relations, also usually specifically where? Gender relations in the family, gender relations at the work, gender relations in relation to war, gender relations in relation to home front. So in 1930s, the Soviet society preparing for war is operating like self-consciously, it's thinking through the category of gender and questioning and kind of having a discussion what exactly gender means. And gender in Russian context has a much more broader meaning than it has been used in academic scholarship by gender historians in relation to Western societies and modern Western societies in particular, where when we mean gender, I would not want to simplify the category of gender, but it is, I mean, we can discuss it later, but gender is an effect of power and culture, right? So we perceive gender as an effect of power and culture, therefore it's a cultural construct, and therefore, and the whole pro, and one of the kind of gender feminist projects would be to use gender as cultural construct and to argue with all biologically related notions of gender. In the Soviet case, and in the Russian case in the 1930s, it was impossible to talk about gender exclusively as a cultural construct. In the Soviet case, and also because of the Russian word that is pole, pole means a cultural biological construct. It actually includes things that, like, for example, intellectuals and educationalists and also ordinary citizens, when they would talk about gender pole or gender relations, they would use, they would both at the same time talk about those cultural trends, those gender relations which are culturally produced in the family, or they're culturally produced through master discourses, and also they would also include motherhood, and they will actually say that you cannot really you cannot dissociate gender from motherhood or gender from fatherhood. So the biological connotation or physiological complications, they all actually belong in the notion of gender. And this particular understanding of gender that I think we need to kind of dig deeper in order to understand allowed the Soviet society in the 1930s, and also with the project of actually reconstituting all those identities, to actually to have very major kind of discussions of what gender differences mean, how women and men should relate to the front. And if gender actually includes culture and nature at the same time, then the discussion ultimately could be narrowed down to the question, at what point when we talk about womanhood, culture ends and nature begins? Or, for example, if we talk specifically in relation to the war, the question that the Soviet society will be discussing in press, in literature, and in private writings would be about what about women's exclusion from combat? Is women's exclusion from combat a bourgeois speculation or bourgeois like misleading? Or is it actually based on physiological peculiarities of male and female bodies? And kind of having posed this question, you can have multiple replies, especially if, as a teenager, you are located in a secondary school, which is completely integrated. Since early 1930s, the Soviet schools are kind of thoroughly integrated. And the imperative of the Soviet school in 1930s for teenagers who are going through that schooling is they have to be different from their parents. The discourse of creating a new woman, creating new gender relations, will be posed to school children as an imperative. They will be invited to be different. And if one reads diaries or memoirs or even letters from the front, women will be writing about that kind of this open-endedness of their identity. They know that they're supposed to become different, and they're supposed to become different in this new integrated school spaces, but they don't know what exactly that means. And I think it's very important for us to start, when we talk about Stalinist culture, to realize that there were certain things which Stalinist leadership was very clear about, like that the necessity for a new man or new woman to be there. And there were certain things which are actually quite under-articulated. For example, one cannot say, I wouldn't be able to say in 1930s, what exactly a new woman was supposed to be. And this was under constant discussion. So, but the institutional settings in which this question, whether female exclusion from combat is a cultural legacy of bourgeois, middle class, traditional societies, or is it actually based on sound science? These questions for teenagers would be answered in their kind of school settings. And I will just give you an example of what exactly the integrated education in the Soviet Union looked like in the 1930s. So basically, all the classes were integrated, like from math to military classes. Women, boys and girls would begin at the age of 12 and 13, they will begin shooting classes. They will actually learn how to shoot a rifle. They would also be, after the age of 16, they will be encouraged to go outside of school and learn military pursuits in paramilitary clubs. And they would be also the school and school teachers will be encouraging children to use this new integrated space in classroom, at the shooting range, also in places where they will be learning how to do medical first aid, which will not be just female, but will be actually very often mixed, to learn and produce this novelty, this new relationships that no one actually knew exactly what they were. And a lot of women actually, and it's very important to like, for the discourse can be powerful only in the case if you actually have, in my opinion, if you have institutional spaces where you can act it out. So for a lot of women in 1930s, a shooting range would be a logical place to go and try to figure out what exactly the difference would be. Because first of all, they're preparing for war, it's a war-oriented society, and there are no real, and there was this kind of invitation to be, not to become like men, but to produce a different notion of difference. And this is actually what we see in this picture. Actually, we have this very, like, this is from 1935, a parade on the Red Square. There are female and male teenagers from Moscow School Number 1 who are, at this age, they're very young, they're just constructing planes, and they're preparing to become a kind of future pilots. And it's not that women are trying to be men, girls are trying to be boys, and boys are trying to be girls, but we actually see that there is this kind of exchange of different kind of symbols of masculinity or femininity in traditional, like men are carrying flowers, and a female teenager is carrying a plane. And if we look at probably a larger picture, you will see this constant rich kind of changing of different objects. So what this, to me, the way I understand that is actually, and I interpret this, also this is, I mean, I'll just give you a few images and I will go into inspiration. This is another kind of aspect of paramilitary education in the 1930s, where women, once they would be asked to go outside of school and learn skills in special clubs, they would never, like, no one would actually draw a clear line where that ends. So these two women actually learned how to drive a tank. And they were featured in Young Communist League newspaper as being one, like, a kind of very good activists in the paramilitary education campaign. So this young woman from 1937, I can't talk about, I don't talk about the socialists, but women very quickly learn how to shoot really, really well, especially teenagers. So once the kind of the campaign for learning how to shoot the rifle and the sniper rifle begins in the early 30s, by late 30s, young female teenagers actually become champions at all union competitions for teenagers. And this is the champion of all union championship for teenagers. And her scores are fantastic. She basically doesn't miss. I mean, she fires from three positions, standing on the ground and when she stands on the knee, and she hits basically everything. And this is, I guess, this is one of the, this is already kind of a cultural commentary of what the artist is seeing happening in the Soviet society, where you actually see a male, a female, I mean, basically, and they don't look teenagers, but it's a some kind of youthful setting, where they are counterposed, but they are not opposed. Like, you can see actually a female who is an aggressive, like, aggressively scores, a male is trying to help her. In fact, it's actually female kind of, how would I say, leaning, like, because the female here looks extremely much more aggressive than male. But for me, what is important, what was kind of important in that, is that this is a commentary to what degree, like, the male and female attributes and identities are being reinterpreted in such a way that they don't stand in opposition physically, or they don't have to stand in opposition to each other, also militarily, and in relation to the future war. I think it's a great... and this is my favorite one that I couldn't include into my book because it was too much work to clean it up. So this is a poster from Young Communist League newspaper for celebrating the International Youth Day in 1935. And it basically is being represented by a Slavic-looking woman with a rifle and flowers. So we have this kind of combination of female flowers and rifle. And basically it's a Chinese soldier who represents the national movement in China in 1930s. In this case, and this will be a very typical thing, in 1930s it is possible to use a female figure as representation of the whole youth. So the female can represent certain aspects of youth in its totality. Like, so she's inclusive. She's including into herself a rifle, and she's including herself a sign of femininity. She's a woman, she is dressed, but she's always ready to pick up her rifle, as they would say at that time, and go to the front. I'll stay here. So this type of... I'll have to move in, so. Okay, so I just want to give a few remarks. I want to give you examples of how their interpretation takes place, basically. in 1930. So the school, because of this incredible, like, basically pressure on children to actually to produce new gender relations, incredibly powerful cultural production of images of women that can actually represent the whole youth and even the whole system. I mean, in a sense, she doesn't represent only the Soviet youth. She represents the Western youth. So this woman represents like the other side of the globe, and the Chinese guys represent the kind of the opposite side of the globe. So in a classroom, this extremely kind of this institutional spaces where women are shooting together, working with boys together, girls. And also in the school, young women remember how they begin already to reinterpret the future front. One of the night bombers, Marina Chechnya, actually has these recollections that the first time when she articulated her idea that she would be fighter pilot was not to her parents or her friends, but it was actually in school. She was asked by a teacher during a literature class whether she who she wants to be, and she said, "Well, I would like to be a fighter pilot." And then again, she would say, well, like Valery Chikalov. And Valery Chikalov was the most famous male pilot of the 1930s. So in a sense, these women and men were invited to identify with opposite sexes as if they're already encompassing the totality. So Marina Chechnya actually said that she wants to be like Valery Chikalov, her classroom, some people in her classroom laughed. And to me, it's of course, we cannot expect that the classroom will be completely isolated or insulated from the larger Soviet society, where we will have traditional and also novel forms of gender representation and gender imagination taking place. But the teacher, which she remembers, told her class to be quiet, and she told her that her dream is a very good one, and she needs to work very hard in order to become a fighter pilot. So for her, it was basically in the classroom, it was this public reaffirmation that her understanding of the male figure as a fighter pilot, as not exclusively male, was correct. And the teacher also, of course, basically thought that she was interpreting the signs very correctly. Okay, what I want to add and end with, I want to end with by saying that in the school place, the school place probably was the only place where this kind of drive for gender experimentation and ways of imagining differences between men and women without opposing between them in relation to different spaces, this will be like the most unproblematic space in the Soviet society. Outside of the school, it will be much more problematic. And paramilitary education, there will be quarters for men and women, but they will not be understood as quarters. They will be understood. So in all other aspects of Soviet society, there will be different principles and different notions of gender and different compromises taking place. But the fact that they actually, for example, the most famous anti-abortion law of 1936, which actually introduces the very central notions of womanhood, which if you're a mother, you are, of course, absolutely cannot fight, this law doesn't discontinue the Soviet educational system and doesn't discontinue the experimentation that is like taking place there. So you actually have a generation that is growing up with this quite diverse notions of gender, which are being produced institutionally, culturally, and by themselves, because they actually have to figure out what message, what exactly they're taking out from education, what they're taking out from larger. So I want to end with some theoretical challenges that I was facing in this work. And it is impossible to talk about the whole book, basically. Okay, I have to say. It should not be as surprising to us that in 1941, like men and women of that particular generation, with this kind of reimagination and also practical, kind of having this practical experiences of preparing and for combat together, that they will be volunteering in 1941. So this is actually, volunteering is very complex, was a very complex process in 1941. It was very much spontaneous, which it was decided by basically an encounter between a female volunteer and a local male officer. And after 42, it will be ready for the Soviet state that will be taking in thousands of women. And that's there's no other way for 500,000 of women to be in the army unless the state gets involved. Like that. But these women are the volunteers of 1941 who volunteered in October 41, and one of them, they're all students. One of them is submachine gunner, and two of them are actually snipers. So they have learned how to snipe, of course, you can say that, before 1941. And one of them, this woman, was supposed to be an actress. And the other one were more involved in technical. They were somewhere aviation and technology institutes. And they survived. So actually, in 1960s, they got together, and another picture was taken of them, but without guns, and in a typical format of the female volunteer, of female veteran. So the challenges that I faced when I started working on this book, and this is kind of what my is. Kind of the material of female entering combat actually is very vulnerable to very quite established and interpretive moves and metaphors that gender history and women's history have produced. So when I began actually writing my book, and I had to write the first three chapters, I started talking about women entering the male space of combat and women combatants destabilizing notions of modern subjectivity. And modern, by modern subjectivity, I meant citizen soldier and modern soldier. And ultimately, I was ending up with this figure of a female combatant who was becoming a soldier. But the space of soldierly identity was still kind of named by me male, because they were entering into male space, and they also were destabilizing figures. And so instance, but in fact, this type of interpretation to me now means is that they were not really like they might be destabilizing the norms, but in my interpretation, I was not destabilizing with kind of this oppositional male female. Kind of vision, I was actually reaffirming it, because unless we think of male and female in opposition relation to combat, we would not say it is destabilizing. Like basically, I had to find a language and a way to talk about gender where this particular entrance would not look destabilizing, because from the point of view of women who went there, they were insisting it should not be destabilizing. I mean, it was for a lot of men, but that was their problem. They didn't. So I actually began reading the text by trying to look at notions of gender and gender differences as not oppositionally generated, where you can have, where they could have very different relationship, where whether, like I want to, I'm proposing in my book a kind of non-oppositional conceptualization of difference that coexisted together with different oppositional configurations in the Soviet society in the 1930s. And also this type of kind of complex ways of arranging male and female without opposing them in different, which is usually opposed, like traditionally in relation to combat, modern combat, mechanized warfare. This actually, for the generation of 1930s and 1940s, was a very long-lasting affair, because they actually devoted their half-lives writing in that particular language and kind of taking it to the full completion in their memoirs, where they produced these narratives where they would specifically use traditional ways of looking at front and soldierhood and womanhood and motherhood, and at the same time they will produce this more alternative and novel ways of kind of their point of view. So they will create those type of narratives, memoirs, where more than one notion of gender will be operating, and that's what I try to do in my book. I try to actually write a book where there will be different notions of gender acting out and interpreted in relation to each other. Thank you very much. This is a state volunteering, I just want to say. And this is another, I want to end with another illustration for the collection of memoirs by female snipers, which I want to be on my book cover, but I didn't get it on there, where you have a female with long hair and with a dead soldier, German soldier, in the background. So it's, again, self-chosen, self-representation for women in 1980s, from 1980s. So. And I'll keep it on. It's called, and the book was called Born in War. Рождённая войной.
I'm sure you'd be happy to entertain questions, right? Please.
Do you want me to?
Oh, you can, yeah. You lie, please, first.
Maybe we can.
Thank you very much. I realize that you're talking about the construction of a Soviet identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I'm very curious about whether it's possible to add any complexity based upon nationality,
mm-hmm.
and ethnicity. If you just have pictures and you don't know who they are, it's difficult to say anything about it. But so, for example, are your authors all Russians or Slavs? Do you have Central Asians? Do we know anything about whether this was exclusively the domain of Russians and Ukrainians and Belarusians, mm-hmm. or others.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, actually, I kind of every character that I carry through is very deeply, I mean, as contextualized as possible. And I have to say that I'm much more, like, the book covers the Soviet Stalinist culture and institutional spaces and in the 1930s. It also works within the gender history and gender kind of challenges. And it also, I also work within the military context. So for me, like, actual military history becomes a very major part of the book in the second part of the book. So the kind of the relationship between this rethinking of gender to national identity, I'm working with the category of Soviet, because the majority of these women actually thought about themselves as Soviet first, and then they kind of, it's very interesting that they actually do articulate their nationality, but that's not a continuous narrative, so it's really impossible to trace it. Of what exactly, how, like, a little bit, some exceptions that I mentioned, but in general, it's a multi-ethnic movement of the, you know, 1941, because it is Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Jewish women, Kazakh, and also, basically this is the most kind of prevalent categories of women, but this is all women who are urban women. So it's women who go through very standard Soviet education, and they actually kind of share a cultural background that they have been accumulating for basically 10 years or 7 years minimum together in different settings. It's a multinational phenomenon which is trying to downplay the nationality and actually insisting on being Soviet. So Soviet young woman, Советская девушка, is the key category of self-identification for them. The nationality will come in when Jewish women would actually fight specific, when German atrocities become, like, known, they will bomb specifically Germans with its kind of, they will add their ethnic national identity to that. Or, like, the same thing with Ukrainian and Belarusian women who would be specifically moving through those spaces. But in general, it's not a developed discourse in their self-representation.
Saw your hand there first, yeah, and then gentleman on the wall, and then Ted, please.
Yeah, I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about how, you know, when you talked about the 60s and 70s, you kind of identified some stable categories that are, you know, revisions of the gender roles in relation to combat. I'm wondering if you could identify, you know, what kind of relatively stable categories there were before the period that you investigated. That, you know, so what were the traditional understandings of male and female relations to combat before the space opened up again for this sort of discussion where things were being reinterpreted?
You mean before 1930s?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I will answer. I'll tell you what I say in my book. The history of what actually, how gender is conceptualized and how tradition is challenged and what is considered to be challenged to tradition has a very, like, basically begins not in 1917, because before 1917, before the Russian Revolution, and also before the Russian Revolution, Russian women's movement, which is, like, very complex. It's middle class. It's also Marxist. They're drawing in very different ways on feminist and women's movements abroad. They're very much, basically, Russian feminists are residing in the West before 1917. So there are a lot of influences of the Western kind, which are not very passively and sometimes very kind of very prominently are present in 1920s and in 1930s in the Soviet discourse. One can also look at Russian particular traditions, which I also think actually we need both to kind of look at them in relation to the West and somehow to differentiate. But the work so far actually that I have, I didn't dare to try to present that I can kind of sum up that richness and the complexity for the book. And that is what, so the way I'm positing myself is that I'm positing what was digested what we have in the 30s out of that pre-1930s tradition in that how it follows. Because the general interpretation is that in the early 1930s, the women's movement, at least in its kind of institutional form, like women's, is kind of discontinued. And then it ends, and especially it ends in 1936 when there is anti-abortion law. My actual interpretation is that just because you discontinue one type of women's kind of equality movement, you actually don't discontinue it in different aspects. And actually the paradox is that it's institutionally the agenda of women's equality becomes fully realized. I mean, not fully realized, but what's the most radical modern kind of realization would be in Soviet schools. So the different agendas actually are pop up in different parts of kind of Soviet culture and Soviet institutions. And to trace kind of the Soviet and trace the Soviet way of thinking about gender as a cultural and biological construct back to Russian, particular kind of Russian language and Russian possibilities within Russian language is like it's one very challenging direction. And to trace it also to Western traditions and Western feminist movements and women's movements is another challenging tradition. And actually, I contemplated the possibility of to look at the Soviet case not as a unique case, but actually as a case intricately connected to pre-1930s, of course, case, but also to larger women's liberation movements, not just basically before 1917, but like, it's a very complex story. I can only basically point directions of study, and I can't tell you like how exactly the production of knowledge actually took place.
Sir.
On a scale, where would you place the role of the Soviet, the Russian woman soldier compared to the American woman and the extraordinary place of the Israeli Defense Forces women?
Mm-hmm.
Where would you place it?
I can only talk about the comparison U.S. and Soviet within the context of World War II, right? Because I don't know how else to draw comparisons. Can I ask you to clarify what you want? How exactly I'm supposed to compare them?
Well, the American women have in the last 30 years
become
much mm-hmm. more towards the model of the Israeli Defense Forces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering mm-hmm. where the Soviet would lie in that
mm-hmm.
scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Soviet armed forces and their incorporation of women into the armed forces are very, I mean, they actually share a lot of similarities and differences with the militaries of World War II, like with U.S. and British militaries. So what is interesting about kind of the Soviet when the Soviet government decided to bring women in, it's actually the first step they make. They decide, I'm separating between women volunteering and spontaneously getting in combat, and when women actually are getting into combat units because they're specifically targeted by the state, and they're being trained. So when the state turns, kind of, in 1942, turns to female volunteering and decide to take into consideration that there are a lot of women well-educated who want to fight, they create multiple streams of how these women will enter into armed forces. They actually create spaces for women who would be non-combatants. They create spaces for women who would be non-combatants but specialists. And they also create spaces specifically for women combatants, and they would use the word woman soldier in their bureaucratic communications. So for them, kind of the category of woman soldier as a state category of mobilization is one of the titles of the chapter. So if one compares, and they also, so they integrate women into high-tech units, like starting from machine gun, which is not very high, I mean, it's very high-tech nevertheless compared to the rifle, but then also into artillery, mortar units, and also they will create a kind of a cohort of women commanders who will be commanding mostly men because there will be not enough women actually in the army at the time. So what the Soviet Union is doing, it's kind of replicating some of the patterns that U.S. and British already are doing. Like, so the U.S. government is taking women into non-combatant positions and not specialized non-combatants, but they don't allow women into combat. In Great Britain, that will be a comparison, another one, is that in Great Britain you have women's participation in anti-aircraft brigades, batteries, but they are, like, the British cultural cultural kind of, the British cultural discourse makes this incredible effort to not call these women combatants, though they are still already in combat. They will be called as not being, like, basically the rule will be for women are not to press the trigger on the anti-aircraft gun, and if they couldn't do it, they were supposed to be non-combatants. So the Soviet Union is very much ahead in bringing women into the military in terms of numbers and in terms of also conceptually, but at the same time, it also kind of follows a lot of standard procedures which are already carried out in World War II by other militaries. So for World War II, the Soviet Union clearly is ahead in terms of, not ahead, like kind of, again, not only practically, but also conceptually, because. But to compare it with the present military, it's very hard, because this World War II combat and World War II armed forces are very different from current state of the army. And so, like, in World War II, you actually still have, it's like, it's also very, very different from World War I. So I'm not sure how to talk about progress here. Like, for World War II, basically, Soviet women combatants participated in basically all forms of, in all, like, participated all branches of all branches of the military, and because they were specifically selected, they did much better than the generic male, because the most men were in their 40s, 50s, not wanting to be in combat. These women were actually very young, like not very young, in their teens or early 20s, very well, usually relatively like wanting to do that and well educated. So, and also they were involved in this type of combat where they could kind of use their own agency, like they would be mostly fighting with combat machines, and not really participating in infantry as infantry soldiers. So I'm sorry, I don't know how to compare.
Ted.
Well, I mean, I actually have about five questions, but I can keep it to one. If I understand correctly, you started out by saying in the 60s and 70s, the official position was that women were not involved in combat, and that was sort of widely accepted and understood. So when these memoirs were actually being produced, how did the sort of conditions of the times during which they were being produced influence perhaps some of the contents and themes and some of the omissions from the memoirs themselves? As a historian, certainly you're very sensitive to the issue of the validity of memoirs, the accuracy, and so what's your sort of thinking about that particular issue? Because if they're written at a time when the official position is women weren't even involved in combat, and here's a woman writing about her experience as a machine gun commander, isn't there some kind of paradox there, or tension, or the fact that this memoir is even appearing might be rather fraught for the writer of the memoir, and they might, and more generally, wouldn't they want to sort of whitewash certain things? I mean, for example, were women involved in the siege of Berlin and we know about the rapes involved in the sort of that process? Is there any? It's a rambling question, but
no.
So maybe I try to give you three of my questions if there was.
Well, I will. I think that what your question about how is it possible for the Soviet 1960s to have this kind of quite diverging narratives, and in fact, like kind of different narratives of what World War II looked from a gender point of view. I think that is for us an opportunity to rethink what we think about post-war Soviet culture, because kind of the sense of it that there was not, like, there was one particular narrative available is actually not. It's not the case. 1960s, and this is how actually I begin to contextualize these memoirs. In the late 1950s, early 60s, actually, the Soviet intelligentsia begins a major project of rethinking the war effort. So it becomes the standard procedure to be critical of the cost and means of World War II. So the first book that has become the national bestseller and defines the kind of this critical trend towards the war would be Konstantin Simonov's The Living and the Dead. And of course, like, there will be like spaces like which were, like, two critical things will not be allowed. But for Konstantin Simonov, his book is about 1941, about those men who happened to be in encirclement, and only out of like 5,000 people that the kind of main character survives. He's the only one who survives. So everyone is lost. So it's a drastic critical reinvestigation of Stalinism, World War II, in an attempt to de-Stalinize the Soviet system. So this critical way of looking at World War II really never discontinues. Like there are basically the kind of representation of World War II in the 60s and 70s and 80s. In the 70s, there will be more celebratory narratives, but still the kind of the death, the abandonment of certain units for absolutely no means of survival would be a very constant theme. And this is the work for post-war Soviet historians, for post-World War II historians of the Soviet Union, to figure out where what was exactly allowed and what was not allowed into that type of representation. So the women who are writing, for example, like Chudakova, since these women are volunteering in 1941, they are all writing about defeats, they're writing about encirclements, they're writing about fighting in besieged cities, and having incredibly high casualty rates. Like, they're the only ones who survive. That's kind of the basic narrative. So they are already participating in a very critical moment that begins in the 60s, and it's never, Konstantin Simonov writes his last part of his trilogy in the 1980s, and all his books are published in millions of editions. The difference between Konstantin Simonov, who's writing about this critical, he's very critical of Stalinism, he just forgets that women fought. And he actually himself suggested to one of his literary friends in 1944 to write about female pilots. And Boris Laskin wrote the very famous play about female combatants who were pilots. So he's more than anybody aware that he knows this woman personally, basically. But there are also different trends of this reinterpretation. There are some writers, popular writers, who would just exclude those women, or they would include them. There is one novel that includes them, but it basically shows how pathetic this was and how unnatural it was for women to be, and they all, of course, die at the end. Right? This is always the stichia, the dawn is quiet here. So I'm actually looking at this as not that actually the state didn't care that much. What exactly were the Soviet women in combat necessarily or not? It's more like Soviet intelligentsia of the war generation making certain choices and making judgments at the Soviet-Stalin state. So one of the judgments would be this state even used women in combat. I mean, this is just completely not acceptable. So for them, it's a critical. And for women who are writing in the 60s and 70s, they are arguing with Soviet and made key intelligentsia. Because Soviet leadership had no problem except kind of announcing it, but it was not very noticeable. By 1960s and 70s, Soviet reading and movie going audience listens much more to Soviet intellectuals than actually to Brezhnev or Khrushchev. And I was very surprised to read that Brezhnev once mentioned that he was in combat and there were women there. But I never heard that. So it's kind of the post-war Soviet culture is extremely, extremely complex. And to me, my interest is to not to use the theme of erasure, because although female and male memoirs are not occupying the center of public debate, they are still existing in the margins, and that still constitutes a cultural realm. So actually, the Soviet society actually did exist by a very broad range of gender discourses throughout, basically, its history from 1920s to 1980s, where you had intellectuals producing them, and then veterans are writing their own stories, and then so that's basically.
We have a question here, and then
maybe
one
we can
collect
a few questions.
Because
I'm not sure when are we in. I can stay here all evening, but I would like to hear questions.
Figure that. No, I've got two questions online, and anybody else, I've got room for one or two more after that. Good. Well, then we've got two questions remaining. Please.
My question is back in the 1930s. In these discussions that you've been describing about, can women be in combat, can women not be in combat, that were kind of going on in Soviet society in the 30s, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about sort of what aspects of the identity of combatant and the concept of combat itself are being invoked. Mm-hmm. And I ask because, I think that helps get at what aspects of gender difference mm-hmm. are at stake in these conversations, mm-hmm. right? So, specifically, are these conversations about whether women should or should not be called upon to be violent actors themselves? Are they conversations about whether women should or should not be called upon to be put in a position of great risk at the front? And so on. So what aspects of the identity of combatant are kind of at the heart of these discussions?
Yeah. It's an excellent question, because it actually allows me also to talk about military history aspect here. The image of this of the future combatant of World War II in 1930s is extremely advanced. We're not talking about rifle soldiers. We're not like so. And some people like, there are a lot of kind of Cold War narratives about how the Soviets thought they can win the war with just their heads. So and they're very prevalent actually. Were very prevalent in 1980s and 90s in the Soviet Union, in the post-Soviet Union culture. So the kind of the image of the what kind of soldier is going to be fighting in the next war in 1930s represents the complexity of the future war. So in a kind of it's a paradoxical thing that kind of in culture, if you actually look at Soviet film and military and just press, you actually realize that the soldier is fragmenting in very specialized occupations. That you actually have, that you will have machine gunners, you will have rifle, of course you will have rifle, right, like infantry soldiers, but you will have machine gunners, you will have artillery soldiers, you will have pilots, which are very famous images. So you will also have snipers. So the idea is that the modern soldier is a complex figure and also requires enormous amount of training. And therefore violence also is not just an emotional act. Violence is a learned skill. So and that's kind of what allows for like for these women to claim to kind of conceive of that, because like the modern soldier is a trained afflictor of technically advanced violence. So in order to know how to fly a dive bomber, you need to learn at least for 2 years, and you need to have experience, right? So the violence becomes a very structured element, and one, even when you read female and male memoirs, you actually can see how well different soldiers were trained. Some of them can read, they know what's going on at the front. They know this is missing, like the plane should be there and the artillery should be there, it's all missing, so we are really in trouble. And by 1944, you can see that, there was this learning mechanism, learning process where they, but those soldiers who are better trained, they perceive war as chaos. So in 1941, because women were better trained and longer trained, they don't perceive war as chaos, and it's another paradox of that. So what was at the core? The core was actually all these aspects, women basically can a woman can be a high tech combatant? Can she be a dive bomber? Can she be a bomber? Can she be a fighter pilot? Can she be a machine gunner? Because of the Anka, the machine gunner made a deep impression on the Soviet society, like a woman who was an image that was created by Soviet cinematography in 1934 of a female machine gunner destroying white guards in Civil War. So all these aspects, and women would actually pick different aspects of what kind of technological part of the war they wanted. And I'm actually making sure, kind of making a point in my introduction, that these women didn't want to be infantry soldiers. They want to have a technical aspect. They want to be modern soldiers, because being an infantry soldier would not really challenge you on the norms that much, because women would always be somehow connected to some kind of infantry connect. Like in Civil War, there will be women in combat, and any type of partisan war, women will be in combat, kind of learning things on the way there, right, or while they are in combat. But they were specifically interested in very kind of in high-tech violence that has structure and requires endurance and knowledge. And that will be the aspect that they will be debating. And violence here becomes now, and violence is a very important part, violence and dying will be at the core. Like, right, because like in a sense, it will be much easier for example, men who will be fighting with women to recognize that women can deliver violence extremely well, but like dying would be still a problematic thing. So all these aspects, and the problem with this, kind of the interesting thing about the Soviet case is that in 1930s, they're not talking about women dying, they're only talking about women being able to kill. So there are certain things that they completely move, they're excluding, for example, they're excluding all the, I would imagine, the Soviet society would be very surprised by a lot of things that was said in the press. So the Soviet press would not allow any contestation of the idea of gender equality. Like in a direct manner, so they will be kept outside of discussion.
And the final question by the door, please.
Oh, thank you. I had two brief questions. The first one, you made comments about the perception of inevitability of war during the 30s. Was that due to the rise of Hitler, or just the concept that the Soviet Union was surrounded by nations that were considered class enemies? Mm-hmm. And then also, could you say something about, you know, what's been the highly romanticized role of women in the partisan groups?
About partisans not qualified. I'll start with partisans because it's very easy. I only work with women who were paratroopers, who were basically recruited by Young Communist League, trained as real infantry soldiers, and like full kind of with all infantry level weapons, and sent into behind the lines. And they would be like, will be like female platoons or female-led platoons often, or mixed platoons, men and women, who would be working in on the German occupied territory in cooperation, in kind of in some kind of agreement with regular troops. So this is the only, and this is, I mean, they these women actually perceived themselves as regular soldiers. They didn't perceive themselves as partisans because they thought, again, this kind of group of women.